I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. King Louis XVI of France gave Benjamin Franklin an expensive present as Franklin was returning to the United States, a portrait of the king surrounded by diamonds set in a golden snuffbox. It was not unusual for monarchs to bestow gifts on diplomats at the time, but it created a problem for Franklin when he got home. His new country was in the process of writing its constitution and wanted to prevent any form of corruption seen as anti-democratic. Our guest, Zephyr Teachout, begins her new book, Corruption in America, with this story. Her book is about the shifting and narrowing definition of government corruption through the country's history, where today it's only quid pro quo, brazen bribery. Back in the 19th century, for instance, lobbying was illegal. Zephyr Teachout is an associate professor of law at the Fordham University, and she challenged Governor Andrew Cuomo last year, the 2014 New York gubernatorial Democratic primary. She got about a third of the vote. And Zephyr Teachout, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's go back to France and King Louis XVI and Benjamin Franklin and even the founders of this country. What were they grappling with when it came to writing the Constitution and thinking about corruption in government and money?
Well, in a lot of ways, corruption was the animating danger at the Constitutional Convention, and not just the convention, but during that time as we were building this new country. And so they actually talked about corruption and thought about corruption and worried about corruption all the time. One of the reasons I use that story about Benjamin Franklin's snuffbox is actually to show how insistent the framers were on defining corruption more broadly than it had been defined in France and in England, because they saw how those countries had sort of been sunk in this rot and muck. And it was all legal, to be very clear. They saw this legal form of corruption really ruining what they saw. You know, Patrick Henry once called England the finest fabric that human nature has ever raised that has been sort of rent apart by corruption. And I actually think this is really important because we're in a crisis of corruption now, to go back and see how much the Constitution was really an anti-corruption document.
Well, in fact, you say even divided government. That when you look deeply at our government and the Constitution, you can see so many different kinds of efforts to prevent corruption.
Yeah, that's right. So I actually got interested in this in about 2007 when I saw the Supreme Court defining corruption in this very narrow way. This is before Citizens United, but you could sort of see the writing on the wall. And I was curious about how the framers defined it, and they defined it broadly. But what was most interesting to me wasn't just how broadly they defined it. It's how often they talked about it. It was almost an obsession. And so you can go through clause after clause or structure after structure. Even the veto clause, when it was debated in the Constitutional Convention, was debated in terms of fears that if the veto number was too large, the executive could effectively bribe the small number of non-vetoing senators. And so there's this sort of daily discussion of what are the threats? And I actually think that's what's interesting.
Well, and I wonder, too, going back to the founders, how did they define corruption? And I think over time we've contracted and expanded the definition. How did they see corruption?
You know, it was so much part of their language. And I think you can think of this of anything that's so deeply part of your language. You don't sit around and define it if you're used to it. You know, people use the words, you know, whether democracy or love, words that are an essential part of your grammar. You're less likely to debate or define. So you don't see debates about it. But what you can conclude from all the discussions is that they were, one, very clearly not just talking about criminal law bribery. We know that in part because there really wasn't very much criminal law bribery, but also those weren't the examples they were using. What they were talking about is when those with public power serve private ends, are greedy, instead of serving the public good. I know, and I've talked to a lot of people about how, you know, that sounds fuzzy at the margins.
It does.
It's difficult to apply in a particular instance, but that's true of all of our really important concepts like free speech, or federalism. And I argue that corruption is a concept like that, with that kind of weight, that's difficult to define at the margins, but the deep ambition is the ambition to protect against selfish, self-serving, greedy people in public power.
I'm curious about what happened when Benjamin Franklin came back to the United States with this snuff box. And you write about this.
Yeah, well, it was one of many gifts that the King of France had given to various diplomats. And we had actually a acting provision. This is pre-constitutional provision that was based on something from the Netherlands, which said that you had to you could not accept these kinds of gifts. And this provision was so outside of the norm that actually one writer said it was against the law of nations.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, everybody gives gifts in diplomacy. That's what we do. But actually, the initial constitution didn't include it, and then it was re-included because the framers thought it was so important to protect against these kind of gifts. And I want to explain why. The fear was not that the king was bribing Franklin. It wasn't that he sort of said, here's a snuff box, and next time you get a chance, insert a positive provision in our trade deal. The concern is that it would actually affect Franklin's sentiments, and he would be
his feelings,
and so that when he was in a position to negotiate with France or to talk about foreign policy, he would think so favorably, he might be blinded to his own sort of sentimental attachments, and that itself is a form of corruption. And I think they're very subtle about their understandings of things that could corrupt us. We don't always see them. They're not always brazen, but it would lead to him not serving the public good, instead serving the French interest. And so then in our Constitution, we do have this provision forbidding taking a gift of any kind whatsoever from a foreign power for those holding office. And, you know, it was honored in the breach from time to time, but it still was an important principle. It was saying we as Americans are different. We are stricter. We are afraid of gifts, actually. We are afraid that gifts can corrupt politics.
But we do know that leaders and monarchs do still give gifts, for instance, to the president. I don't know. Are they just kept in a gigantic warehouse somewhere?
Well, to be clear, you're allowed to keep the gift if Congress gives permission. And actually, this really bothered Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson, I love as a character because he's sort of our favorite hypocrite. He both holds up the highest standards and then violates those standards. That's certainly true with slavery. Also true with this gift-giving provision. And now he was very strict about these questions of gifts and corruption. Yet when he himself later was given a diamond-encrusted gift, At first, he tried to resist it because he just didn't want the embarrassment of going in front of Congress to ask permission to keep it. And then he didn't resist it, but told his assistant to take all the diamonds out, sell them, and put the money towards his own account. And he hid the whole affair entirely.
Why does that have a kind of familiar ring to
yes.
it, right? But this is, I guess, human nature up against these values, right?
Yeah. And I actually think that's why the rules are so important. Not because even the best among us might not violate them, but because they're kind of speed limits on our own ethical obligations. Maybe I'm mixing metaphors too much there, but these rules give us guideposts about, wait a second, we might be actually overstepping the bounds. And if there's clear lines saying this is ethically acceptable and this isn't, that helps us serve our public better.
I do want to get to the 20th century and even the 21st century talking about this, but just spend a little bit of time on the 19th century, which we do think of as a time of robber barons and the building of the railroads and the various scandals associated with this expanding country. How do you see that fitting in?
Oh, there's so much really interesting history. So, excuse me. So you have this, you know, this constitution built around protecting against corruption. And, you know, Mason said, if we don't protect against corruption, we will soon be at an end. And Hamilton said, you know, when he asked about what we did at the Constitutional Convention, he wrote, we erected every practicable obstacle against corruption. So they saw this as this anti-corruption document. And then, of course, the country begins with a scandal. And one of the first scandals that really occupied our country, actually for decades, was the Yazoo scandal. Yeah. So in Yazoo, the Yazoo lands in western Georgia were sold for basically pennies on the acre, what somebody called the real estate deal of the century. The legislature of Georgia allowed this sale, and over half of the legislators actually had stock and had a financial interest in the sale themselves. So the people of Georgia were understandably very upset. They'd lost this major asset, kicked out every single legislator, set fire to the law that had granted this land to these private companies. They actually literally had a bonfire, passed a new law saying that law is void, and then assumed that they owned the land. But there was this legal question, and my research is really about the law, less about the scandals necessarily are part of it, but it was like, what does corruption mean? How does corruption work in law? How does this difficult concept work in law? So the legal question, which is really tricky, is a law not a law, or because it was passed corruptly? Is a law not a law because over 50% of the legislators were bribed? Or can you overturn those laws? And that's, you know, you can understand why that's a really tricky question for the mm-hmm. courts. The Supreme Court, Justice Marshall, ended up deciding that it was just too difficult to figure out in any given case whether a law had been passed corruptly or not, and so upheld the sale.
But I wonder whether the fact that so many of these legislators were kicked out, whether it's the courts or the law says, well, then the voters step in and they, in a sense, void the law.
Well, actually, that's
even if they don't set fire to it.
Right. Well, election helps, but it doesn't help so much if you've already lost all your assets. And so that was why it was a tricky question. But in response to that and several other scandals, you see the rise of something that was relatively new at the time, which is these criminal bribery laws. Because actually, when that happened in Georgia, there were none of those legislators could be put in jail because there was no laws against legislative bribery. So you see a rise of criminal bribery laws, and then you also see the rise of a real concern around lobbying.
Mm.
And really for 80 years of our history, as you mentioned in the introduction, lobbying was either illegal or against the public policy of the states. It was a felony in California. The 1877 Constitution of Georgia included lobbying as a crime in the Constitution. And, you know, my favorite stories actually involve the court cases around lobbying, though.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Zephyr Teachout is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She has a new book called Corruption in America, and it's subtitled From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United. And we are getting a short history lesson of corruption, how the founders thought of corruption, and we are slowly marching our way to current day. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Zephyr Teachout about her new book called Corruption in America, From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United. She's an associate professor of law at Fordham University. So during the 19th century, lobbying was essentially seen as, what, illegal, a form of bribery?
It was seen as illegal and corrupt. And the way this was policed was not through criminal laws. And you just have to imagine a world in which, in general, these criminal laws are not getting enforced. And so you need to look elsewhere for ways to protect against corruption. And the way that they would protect against what they saw as the corrupting influence of lobbying was through contract law.
Oh, interesting.
So let's say, you know, you hire me to fix your roof, which would probably be a bad idea, but let's say you do that.
I've done things like that before.
And I fix your roof, and then I ask for payment, and you refuse to pay me. I would bring you to court and sue on the contract. So that would happen in lobbying cases, except courts would say we aren't going to enforce that contract to lobby because it's against public policy. So imagine, say, we had a contract to sell a child, or a contract in a lot of states to sell an organ, or a contract to sell sex. All of those, even now, are unenforceable contracts. So you'd see that with lobbying. So the lobbyist would get hired and then go to court and say, pay me. And the person would say, no, it's I'm not going to enforce it. It's against public policy to lobby. Now, the best example of this, I think, is this old man in Virginia who was owed tens of thousands of dollars by the U.S. government. And he was too old to travel even to Washington, D.C. to ask for his money back. So he hired a lawyer. The lawyer went to Washington, met with Congress members, actually got the money back. And then the old man says, "That's thank you very much. I'm not going to pay you because that was a contract to lobby."
Oh, wow.
And so this lawsuit goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And there's no evidence in this case that the lobbyist had bribed lawmakers, which was a real concern, that basically if you're paying a lobbyist, they're going to pay the lawmaker to get the whatever you want done. No evidence of that in this case. But the Supreme Court nonetheless sides with the old man and says, no, we will not enforce this contract to lobby. Lobbying is inherently corrupt. Mm-hmm. If we're to allow lobbying, the great adventurers of our day will hire people to go past the great – sorry, the great corporations of our day will hire adventurers. You know, basically, we can't allow lobbying in this – even in this small instance, because if we allow it in the small instance – corporations will hire lobbyists, and every right-thinking man, they said, would, you know, denounce this as corrupt.
So when did all that change?
Well, it actually changed kind of gradually. When I was reading the cases, it felt sometimes more like, you know, the way your coat or shawl slips off the back of your chair and then you can't find it. It felt that like that gradual slipping away more than a sudden reversal. And it really changes in the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s. And what you see is a few different things. First, courts are far more likely to enforce contracts across the board and not have this public policy exception, like just the idea that if you make a contract, that's your business. And the second is that you see really the creation of the modern First Amendment. And those two together combine in these incremental cases to erode this old law set of laws and establish lobbying in its current position, which is exactly the opposite. It's not seen as corrupt. It's seen as sort of the epitome of protected First Amendment speech.
Which is so interesting. And there was a very important case in the 20th century, the
Buckley versus Vallejo.
Vallejo.
In 1976.
Which kind of set the stage for this idea that speech and money were somehow connected.
Yeah. I like to joke that, you know, Benjamin Franklin said that our country would last a couple hundred years, but we didn't think he'd be so precise because Buckley versus Vallejo was 1976. And in that case, the Supreme Court struck down parts of a federal law that was designed to do something about campaign finance. This is in the sort of post-Watergate era. It actually, the Supreme Court upheld laws that limited how much you could contribute to a candidate, but struck down the laws that limited how much you could spend on a campaign. And you have to understand how unusual this is. In Europe, there's limitations on how much you can spend, not just how much you can contribute. And it did so because it said, you know, spending money is First Amendment protected speech in this context.
Is that making the connection between lobbyists? I mean, people who get paid to express an opinion to our elected officials?
Yes. So that case wasn't actually about lobbying, but it did epitomize a view that political speech is the most protected speech and money spent around political speech is the most protected speech. So actually, ironically, we've never had that direct is how protected is lobbying case. There have only been peripheral cases. But since Buckley versus Vallejo, I'm going to get into the weeds here, so be a little patient.
Weeds are important.
Yeah. So in Buckley versus Vallejo, the Supreme Court said you can from time to time pass – not time to time. You, Congress, state legislatures can pass laws that infringe upon this First Amendment, a protected political speech right, but only if they narrowly serve the purpose of fighting against corruption.
Uh-huh.
So what that later was interpreted to mean is that if you passed a law to equalize power, that would necessarily be struck down. The only reason you could pass a law that might infringe on those First Amendment interests was corruption, which is why corruption became such a legally important word. Because then we really, really care what corruption means. And if it means something broad, like what the founders meant, that means that there's actually a range of anti-corruption laws you can pass. But if corruption means only explicit quid pro quo, where there's a spoken exchange, it means you can't pass very many anti-corruption or very many reform laws at all.
And that's where we are today.
And that's where we are today.
So it's really just that sort of overt bribery, right? Is that now there our narrow definition of corruption?
Yeah. You start to see this in 2007 again, which is the case that piqued my interest, when Justice Roberts actually gets impatient. He says, enough is enough. If you think corruption is anything, and he actually uses that phrase, enough is enough, period. He's responding to the dissent's view that corruption is something more than explicit bribery. But after 2007, in Citizens United, one of the key reasons the Supreme Court struck down outside corporate spending in Citizens United is because there was no evidence that it was protecting against explicit quid pro quo bribery. It was protecting against broad corruption, but not that explicit quid pro quo bribery. And then last year, the Supreme Court not only made it very clear that explicit quid pro quo bribery was the only kind of corruption, it actually cited to a federal statute. So corruption is no longer treated as this foundational principle, but rather something that you can look at in a federal criminal bribery law statute.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Zephyr Teachout, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She has a new book called Corruption in America. That's what we're talking about. And it's subtitled From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United, A Short History of Corruption in America. And she is an associate professor of law at Fordham University. Last year, she challenged Governor Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic gubernatorial primary in New York. Got about a third of the vote. Not bad for someone who had never taken on such a big political operation as that. To join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I can see some emails and some comments at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. This will show my complete naivete as a non-lawyer. But has the court grappled with the idea that the more, under their definition of speech and money, that the more money you have, you get more speech? I mean, does that even hold legal water?
Well, actually, this court has really rejected the idea that it is a legitimate goal of lawmakers to try to equalize speech. So they approach that same question from the opposite point of view. And if you make that kind of argument, there's an almost allergic reaction on the part of the majority of justices now. And you can actually, just to be sympathetic for a second, you can understand there's a fear that, the lawmakers are out to actually equalize speech. That's impossible. That sounds kind of draconian and top down. But I think actually one of the arguments of the book is I actually think they're really deeply naive.
This would be our
Supreme own Court. Supreme Court is deeply naive, and they don't actually understand that the matters of degree matter enormously. And that, yes, people are always going to have different capacity to speak, whether it comes from charisma or money or organizing capacity or something else. But when you get to the level of disproportionate power that you're talking about with the current post-Citizens United scheme, under a scheme where elections are privately financed, you actually move away from democracy itself. And it's actually quite striking that this court has no members who've been in politics themselves. Actually, the two times that we've had no politicians on the court are 1976, Buckley versus Beliau. Then Sandra Day O'Connor joins the court, who has extensive experience in politics.
And very much the swing vote. During her tenure.
Exactly. And once she leaves, it's actually the moment she leaves, the court then goes again to this model of all, heavily protecting money in the political sphere. And I actually do think they just don't understand how insidious it is.
I mean, as smart and well-educated, as you say, largely either from academia or through the appellate court system. So they have come to the Supreme Court from a couple of different avenues. But because they have never run for office, they don't understand something?
Well, I'd like to think that you can understand something without having run for office. But
I would like to think so, too.
But I do think that they do come from a pretty isolated sort of pedigree, I guess. And I think that it brought something to the court when people had that experience on the court, which they always had. So I can tell you from running for office myself, although you common sense tells you this, is that when you're raising money, you don't have to have a quid pro quo conversation to understand that donors want particular things from you. And so most of the time when donors are exercising power, they never have to write down a contract. They just have to – you know that they can give you $10,000 and you know what their policy priorities are. And that's really all you need to know if you're a desperate politician. And politicians are all desperate right now for money. So I don't think they know that feeling and the psychological impact of this. But the reason I go that way is I have really struggled with understanding where this court is coming from. You know, what is motivating this court? Because I think this series of decisions are truly tragic. You know, tragic in the sense that, you know, a tragedy follows the arc of something wonderful, and then the thing that is your greatest value is your downfall. And I feel like that's true of the First Amendment, is the idea that the First Amendment, which is such an important, extraordinary American value, would be the tool through which we are undermining our own democracy and our own open political debate is actually tragic. And so, like, what is driving this court is something I have a bunch of different answers for, but that really puzzles me.
I cannot represent the ACLU in our discussion here, but I know that they are at least one of, I think, several what we would think of as kind of progressive First Amendment supporters who don't seem to have a problem with Citizens United.
Yeah, I think they're wrong.
You think they're wrong?
Yes. And I think they're wrong, again, not because I don't think the First Amendment is an important value, and not actually, to be fair, that I think that we shouldn't genuinely be concerned if government is involved in money and politics. We should. I just also think there's extraordinary countervailing values. And that extraordinary countervailing value is the value of actually not having those in power serve private interests instead of the public interest. And right now we've built an architecture designed to corrupt our public officials. Like, if you wanted to build a machine that said, let's take good people or people who want to serve the public and make them serve private interests, you'd build our current private financing scheme with super PACs. That's what you'd build. So again, I think it's a form of naivete. The First Amendment is an extraordinarily powerful thing, but it is not the only value.
I wonder, though, and there's, you know, during a campaign, as we all know, and you probably know better than most of us, all the money seems to be going into ads, whether they're largely on television or largely on radio or sometimes in print as well. But the airwaves are allegedly owned by the public. I mean, if you got the money out of those kinds of expenditures, would it somehow help to equalize the system and take out some of the bad influence of money?
So what's your proposal?
Well, my proposal is if the airwaves belong to the public, they should be free, right? But companies are making money hand over fist during a highly expensive, highly charged political campaign.
Well, actually, no. I like that. There's different ways to basically enable. I almost think of it as freeing politicians from these sort of dependencies on you know, pretty narrow selfish interests. One is to provide a matching fund system where if you show a certain amount of support, you get direct funds. Another is to provide free access to the airwaves so that you don't have to fight for that. I think that's very valuable. You know, perversely, one of the functions of money in our current system is to determine viability. So early money is so important because the press, not wanting to make any kind of subjective judgment about who would be a good senator or who would not, often uses money as a proxy for, you know, how viable, how serious a candidate is. And so ironically, you know, you raise money in order to get press, and then the press itself is where the battle is fought out. So my goal, I mean, I object deeply to what the Supreme Court has done. I think we should be actively figuring out, you know, I encourage even thinking about court packing. Really understanding that the Supreme Court striking down these laws is a serious threat to our democracy, and merely complaining is not enough. And even merely asking for a constitutional amendment is not enough, because we know how difficult that is.
But you're saying court packing, which is get those people on the Supreme Court who understand what it is you're talking about?
Well, actually, you know, we can add justices to the Supreme Court. There's nothing that limits that. And this is what FDR did when he found a court that was consistently striking down democratically passed important laws. He threatened to add justices to the court, and the court got its act together. What I mean by raising that is that we have this serious threat, and we should be talking about the, you know, how can we change the institution of the court? But I, having said that, I actually think the most important reform we could do now is actually within what the court allows, which is public financing of elections.
We're almost having a break here. Do you think the low voter turnout, it's not always low voter turnout, but certainly during primaries and certainly during off years, is a sign of the public's frustration with the system, or their lack of belief in the system because of money and because of influence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it reflects itself in a couple of different ways. One is just sort of a lack of belief in the system as a whole, and people feeling out of power. And this is the democratic idea, is that you actually have power. But the other way which I think it affects things is actually it changes who runs for office, and people are not inspired by those who they see as beggars. So I'm hearing music.
You are.
Okay.
You're a very good guest, because you stopped talking just this moment that the music rang. And that's Zephyr Teachout, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Again, the author of a book called Corruption in America. And she is an associate professor of law at Fordham University. We have a lot of people that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Zephyr Teachout is our guest. She's an associate professor of law at Fordham University, a leading authority on government corruption. Her book is titled Corruption in America, From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United. And we've been talking about some of this history in this hour of Radio Times. Let me get Jose from Burlington County to join us on Radio Times. Jose, go ahead. You're on the air. I think you need to turn your phone down. Is that what?
Yes, I did.
Okay, go ahead, Jose.
Yes, could you speak to the issue of access and money? The idea that money buys access, and that access translates into power, leads the public into an environment which they are very, very distant from. It creates apathy, indifference, and basically they walk away from it. Keeping this relationship very simple, money buys power. Power buys access. Access gets things done, and it's usually not in the best interest of the public.
Jose, let me give our guests a chance to respond to that. Is that kind of summarize what you've been saying?
No, absolutely. And I think what you're saying is something so important. It's something the Supreme Court has explicitly rejected. It has said that access is not corrupting and not corruption. And therefore, laws that are designed to sort of end that little system, that little cycle that you're talking about that is so corrosive, will be struck down as violating the First Amendment. They don't support the anti-corruption principle. But it's so important, because just think of yourself. Like, even in a non-transactional way, you're going to have – your cares are going to be informed by the people you talk to. So if you only talk to people who've never had trouble getting a dentist and don't have to deal with credit card debt, you're not going to be trying to solve the problem of dental care and credit card debt, you know, while you're sleeping. You're going to be trying to solve the problem of the 1% or the people who are funding you. And so access The access that comes with fundraising, I believe, as you are sort of so eloquently putting it, is so essential and so deeply corrupting.
Jose, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What's so interesting, you described the founders earlier on thinking about some of these unconscious influences, wanting to get money out of the system, knowing that people might not know their own impulses and just wanting to protect them, in a sense, from themselves.
Yeah, I think it's so important to be human about this. And to sort of understand human sympathies. So one of the tragedies, besides the First Amendment tragedy, that I see is that our current system takes our best features and turns them into corrupting forces. So one of our best features is to care and love and listen about those that we talk to. But then if you take that radical empathy and then you're spending all your time with the richest people in world history, and if you're fundraising – people who can give $2,000 are pretty rich, and people who can bundle in the hundreds of thousands of dollars are extremely rich. So you're using all your empathy and orienting it towards that category instead of towards the public, and it feels tragic because we want people to be empathetic. We want people to listen to those they talk to.
I mean, are we talking about then legal corruption? I mean, I don't even know if that phrase exists.
No, yes, it is. And I actually think if you talk to people – anywhere in the country except the Supreme Court, they talk about corruption in this way. I think the Supreme Court has gone off on this very narrow idea that it's got to be criminal law bribery. But I think people feel very comfortable calling a situation corrupt even if nobody's going away in handcuffs.
Does it also raise questions about perhaps Congress not playing its role as the third branch of government? Is there something you think Congress could do to not just challenge the court, but also to raise some of these issues?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's other things that are happening now. For one, you see over 50% of Congress members are now becoming lobbyists after they leave office. And actually, the framers were concerned about a variation of this. They called it the problem of placemen, people who would people who would go into office – go into elected office in order to get an appointed office from the king. And so the problem was they would basically just serve the king instead of serving their constituencies. Now we have the problem of placemen, but it's people serving their future employers, serving the lobbyists that they're going to work for. And we could certainly do more with the revolving door. And, you know, members of Congress, I think, are realizing that most Americans are opposed to Citizens United. And so many have come forward supporting a constitutional amendment. But what they could do is actually change the way that campaigns are funded. And they're scared to do it because it changes what their jobs are. You know, they're used to their job of being, you know, fundraiser. Basically, you know, the job of being a congressperson now is basically the job of being a salesperson. How many calls can you make? What percentage can you hit?
And they all complain about it, but they all do it.
But they're still scared. Yeah. And I think, you know, there is actually a great opportunity for Congress to act and recognize that they should fundamentally change their jobs, but fundamentally uncorrupt Congress by a public financing scheme.
Let me see what Dennis from Broomall has to say. Dennis, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm hung up in with the Supreme Court aspect, and that being that, you know, while we all move along doing our day-to-day things, you see these guys going to big events in Palm Springs, sponsored by the brothers. We know what they're doing. They're not coming to my house and asking me, as the Speaker is suggesting. How do we put them in the spotlight so they can't do this? Cavalier about it.
Well, Dennis, we don't have the greatest phone line, but let me give our guests a chance to respond.
I could hear you, Dennis. And this is something that I struggle with all the time, too, because, you know, we have a long tradition of, you know, even civil disobedience when necessary against our elected officials. But the court's in a different position. You know, civil disobedience against the court, that doesn't do anything necessarily in the same way. I think you're right to raise the spotlight. I think you are right to openly call into question the court. And, I think as a law professor, we're trained to hold it up as this sanctimonious institution. But I actually think that this court is so deeply troubling that we should call that into question. Mm-hmm. And the very legitimacy of the court is called into question by this real use of power in this case. This is one of the reasons that I support thinking about court packing, adding the number of justices, which is, you know, something Obama could push, to say, look, we have a court that is so threatening our society that we can do something about it. But I would say more broadly, I'm actually with you on the dilemma that this court, which has done so many – a Supreme Court, which has done many extraordinary things in our history, is now doing – you know, we're 5 years into Citizens United, and we already see the Koch brothers threatening to spend more than any party has ever spent in a
almost $1 billion.
Yes, in a presidential election.
Dennis, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I can imagine, though, if President Obama talked about packing the court, I can imagine the pushback that he would get.
Oh, okay. Yes, I can imagine the pushback, too. But to Dennis's point, though, I really do think the House is on fire in terms of our democracy. And I do see some real ways, some sort of openings and some possibilities for hope. But I don't think we should be cavalier about the threat that is posed. And when I look at world history, this is the way in which I'm very sympathetic to the way the framers thought about it, is a democracy is a very rare and precious thing. We can't take it for granted. And we, you know, for all our flaws, we have an extraordinary tradition in this country of people really taking responsibility for governing ourselves collectively and for caring about the public good. And I am really driven by a love of that tradition and wanting to protect it from the real – what I see as the real threat of big money.
Is this as you look at the Supreme Court and you look at people that are there because of various presidents, is this a partisan court? I mean, do you see, for instance, Supreme Court justices who were nominated by a Democratic president different from ones who were nominated by a Republican president?
I mean, there's a partisan element to this now, but there hasn't always been. Justice Rehnquist, dissented in an important case, arguing that, yes, we could limit corporate involvement in politics. You know, we create corporations, therefore there's no reason they have to be able to be involved politically. Sandra Day O'Connor, a Republican appointee, cared a lot about this. I don't actually think this necessarily has a – it certainly doesn't have a traditional partisan flavor.
Let me see what Steve from Upper Freehold has to say. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I was glad that I just jumped in the car and turned on the radio and came across you guys.
Great. Go ahead.
It's a couple things. First of all, it sounds very familiar, the same that you're talking about corruption in politics. Things like Lawrence Lessig has been bringing up.
Funny you should say that, Steve, only because he was a guest on the show last year and actually had been a supporter of our guest as she was running for
Larry Lessig and I are old friends, and I, in fact, every January now go hike across cold New Hampshire with him to talk about these issues. I was, yes.
Steve, hold on one second, only because we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Just pick one question for us. Go ahead.
Okay. So one of the things, when I came back to New Jersey, I was up there with Larry this past year, and I got involved with a group called Wolfpack. And basically what they're looking to do is we're trying to get free and fair elections done, get the citizens, you know, United overturned, but more getting, again, corruption out of politics. And instead of going it on the federal level, working it through the states. And currently we have 3 states that have gone through this. We need 34 states to get involved. What were your feelings on this, and if you could comment on it?
Steve, thanks for the call.
Yeah, delighted to hear about what you're doing, and you're an inspiration, I hope, to other listeners that you can get involved with Wolfpack or Larry Lessig's May Day Project or Every Voice. There's a bunch of different projects. I actually think none of us know exactly what's going to work, but we know that work is what's going to make it possible. So I personally also, along with you, Steve, am very focused on the state level. Living in New York and being involved in New York politics, I care a lot about New York, but I think New York can actually take the lead on public financing of elections. And the more states that have that, the more we're going to see a domino effect. In the 19th century, you saw, I don't know if people know this, but your vote did not used to be secret until the 1880s. People voted publicly. That was just the way you voted. And then there was a real concern about corruption, that basically people were bribing, especially the leading members of a community, for their vote because everybody could see it. So they would pay up to $250 for a vote. And then in a 10-year period, the secret ballot swept the country as an anti-corruption measure. And it really, you know, basically every state flipped within a very short amount of time. And I hope the same thing can happen with these kinds of reforms. And I do think the state level is critical.
Is that why you ran for governor in New York?
Well, I ran because I thought I would be a better governor than Andrew Cuomo.
Well, I know that. I know
But I also I think there's a lot of opportunities in the states for – states are crazier. They're stranger. They're in some ways more maddening, but that the fact that they're more maddening also makes there be more openings for exciting revolutionary things to happen. And so I really encourage state-level activity.
Are you, though, disheartened? I mean, do you feel to the point where we have created a system that just allows this kind of corruption?
Yes to the second half. Yeah. No to the first half. I'm not disheartened. You know, people find hope in different places. I find hope by thinking about how it would feel in 1900. So 1900, there's a civil war that has been fought, a terrible civil war that has been fought, at least in part in the name of ending slavery, and African Americans have no economic and political rights. Suffragists have been organizing for decades, and women have no right to vote. And the anti-monopolists have been trying to break up big companies, and steel and railroads and oil and J.P. Morgan own the country. Now, you could give up then. You could be disheartened. But I actually think of that time to say, oh, no, we actually got out of that time. We got out of it because of these organizing like the organizing Steve is doing and other people are doing. It doesn't always move in a straight line, but mm-hmm. it enabled the kind of transformational change where all of those, you know, really terrible pathologies were overcome.
I mean, is it the pendulum swing? We go so far in I guess power and access to power, and then there are unions and organizers are pushed back, and then we
I resist the pendulum swing because I think the pendulum swing leads people to passivity, the sense that it's just the pendulum. It's now everything's gone too far. It's going to swing back on its own. And what I have seen when I have traveled to other countries and what I have traveled to ancient history in my reading is that the pendulum does not swing always towards justice. So instead, you know, again, this idea that it is a rare and fragile thing, it is possible but not necessary that we will get out of the current, I think, real crisis of corruption.
And what would our founders who were grappling with this issue of corruption, what would they say about the government we have today?
I think that they would, you know, what would the founders say is actually fun to think about, but in a very serious way.
I mean that seriously.
Yeah, I think in a very serious way, they would see that the character of our government is corrupt, and it's corrupted by the way that we fund campaigns.
And I mean, we're coming up on a presidential – I mean, it seems we're always in the middle of some kind of campaign. Do you see some brightness, some ideas?
Well, there's a lot of ideas. What we have not seen is any of the sort of announced presidential candidates take on these issues of fundamental structural reform in a serious way at all.
And is that what you're looking for in a sense?
Of course. Yeah. No, I think, you know, unfortunately, the presidential campaign has become sort of all-consuming sport. And I think the founders would be concerned about the presidency playing this sort of oversized role in our democracy, that local democracy should be equally important in a lot of ways. But the key is, I think there's an opportunity for structural reform, and I hope somebody grabs it.
Well, Zephyr Teachout, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's wonderful to be on. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, her book is called Corruption in America, From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United. And she's an associate professor of law at Fordham University. And again, she challenged Andrew Cuomo for the Democratic primary governor of New York last year. Go to hyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in the first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.